You ready?
Wait, do you want to ask anything?
I do have a few questions.
Okay. Well, what I'm going to do then is that I shouldn't have turned the recorder off when Jerry asked for a break. I'm going to, the business about who won the election, I think we want to get that anecdote in there about the cartoon with you and the money coming out your pockets. By the way, I heard you interviewed on the radio the other day about the new football stadium.
Yeah, I was. I was in the, you listened to the radio at a weird time. It was like 9:10:30 in the morning or something.
Well, I don't really listen to WIBC except when I'm on the road and I want to know what the traffic is.
Uh-huh.
And I was out going somewhere and I turned it on to get the traffic report.
Oh, yeah.
There you were.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, back on.
Okay, we're back on. And while we had the recorder off, one of the people in the room brought up an issue about Gerald Bepko, about the aftermath of the election for governor, in which he mentioned that he had introduced you at a public affair and raised the question about who really won. And you mentioned a cartoon that was in the Star.
Well, of course. But what had happened was the state of Indiana was having some budget problems, and Evan Bayh, who I lost to in the election, was struggling with those questions. And the editorial cartoon showed me sitting at a desk with money all over the desk and coming out of my pockets and so forth, and it showed Evan with a worried look on his face, and the line was something about who really won. And so that was kind of fun, you know, fun with the process.
I'm going to ask John Beeler, who's the graduate research assistant on this project, if he wants to ask a few questions, and then we'll move on with some of the standard questions that we have on leadership.
Mr. Mutz, how would someone in 2006 go about forming a city committee in Indianapolis? If I were to go out and do it right now.
Well, you know, I don't know, because I had hoped for quite a while that this would happen again. There'd be a rebirth of this sort of thing. I kind of hoped that some of the leadership organizations like Stanley K. Lacey Leadership, which has a built-in alumni and group of people that you'd think might fit in this category. But you know what I think the ingredient would be that would make this work? And that would be is if Lilly Endowment or the Central Indiana Community Foundation would be the convener. Now, they don't have to run it. They don't have to tell people what to do, et cetera. In fact, it'd be better if they didn't. But I think somebody with convening power could get this done. I'd have to tell you, quite frankly, that the city committee came together, first of all, because of Jim Morris. And it came together because of where he sat. Now, he was not at that time president of Lilly Endowment. He was a program officer. But everybody knew he was working with the approval of the leadership there, including Tom Lake. And it was fun. We had a good time in that situation. But the leadership of the whole thing then just began to come together because we interacted with each other. We did a lot of stuff socially, too. It was fun. I mean, as I think I told you before, I can't think of any time in my life when I was more excited about getting up in the morning and I involved in my business, yes. But this was where the real excitement was, you know.
Yeah. So with regards to this, say someone gathered this power to convene, what do you think the composition of a 2006 city committee would look like in comparison to that you were a part of?
Clearly, it has to have women in it. I mean, that, in my mind, was a big piece of the total population that wasn't present. Secondly, the effort at a little more diversity probably would be appropriate in today's world. And I guess one of the things that occurred to me about this since then is that within the religious community, there is some leadership developing that might logically be included there.
Is that a lesson you've learned from Lilly?
I think my involvement with Lilly Endowment, yes, definitely taught me that. And of course, also the time period when Dick Lugar was mayor of Indianapolis and we were worried about racial problems here and damage and physical harm to people. And it was the religious community that stepped up, in my opinion, and made the difference. I've said this to you, I think, in a previous interview session. And it was primarily men at that point of the Protestant religions and the Catholic religion who came together with the African-American leadership and said, we can walk down the streets together. We can prevent this from happening. Now, I'm making this ultra-dramatic here, but it was pretty dramatic. And out of that came a bunch of other things, which I think, I don't want to say defused this issue, that's terrible jargon, but I think it eliminated what could have been a terribly bad situation.
Switching to your work as Lieutenant Governor and trying to get foreign investment, did you have a strategy for dealing with the xenophobia? You've talked about the nature of xenophobia.
Yeah.
But did you have a specific strategy?
Well, our strategy obviously wasn't as effective as we'd like for it to be. Of course, what we were talking about was that people wanted jobs badly. We had a terribly scary set of circumstances with double-digit unemployment. I mean, more than double what it is presently. And our strategy, of course, was that this is good for your economy. And secondly, that nearly everybody in these new foreign investments who work there will be Americans. There's very few foreign citizens here. Our other strategy was to get local communities, religious leaders and everybody in the local community, but like a go to a place like Greensburg or someplace like that, and get them to rally around this new investment and to welcome the people when they got there. I mean, this is one of those things that once you get to know the Japanese, they really aren't as scary as they seem to be to a lot of people at that point. That was the strategy.
Okay. I guess that also speaks to the third question I had, and that is, what does Hoosier leadership look like as opposed to leadership in another state? Or
I'm not sure I'm qualified to compare, quote, Hoosier leadership. There's no question about the fact that we don't have as much of it as we seemingly had 20 years ago and 30 years ago. Now, part of that is due to the fact that so many of our industries are no longer owned and headquartered here. I mean, that's a clear deficiency in the leadership pool. I believe that in the longer haul, the philanthropic community will fill in some of the vacuum of leadership. In my book, my Fundraising for Dummies, I talk about the rise of the nonprofit sector as a leader of local communities. The other part of that is the university community. It will become more important, and you can already see it happening in Indiana. I mean, who would have ever thought of Purdue University advertising on billboards and calling themselves the business makers? I mean, 20 years ago, faculty senates and others were very, very disturbed about that kind of stuff. They saw it as an infringement on academic freedom and all kinds of stuff. And there may be people at Purdue who still feel that way, there's definitely a change. There's a leadership coming from the university community, which is part of the nonprofit sector. So
do you see, as a result of economic change in Indiana and the Midwest, a vacuum in leadership?
Well, to be sure, there is somewhat of a vacuum, particularly in individual communities. And what you do about that, I'm not sure. As I said, I think it's going to come out of the philanthropic sector to start with. Obviously, the political sector has always been part of that. I mean, for example, right now, every local government leader, county commissioner or mayor, considers as part of his portfolio economic development. That's not in Byrne statutes anywhere. That was never envisioned as a responsibility of a mayor. And you've got mayors now traveling all over the world looking for jobs for people and investment opportunities and so forth. The circumstances are changing. The Middle West as a region has a lot of this difficulty. I mean, we're not unique. Ohio's suffering and Illinois, Kentucky, so forth, Michigan. In fact, Michigan is even describing itself as a depressed state in a sea of prosperity, which is, you know, not sure that's exactly the image I want to project, but anyway, that I've heard some people refer to them that way. And that's the decline in manufacturing, the increase in the service industry, and so forth. But overall, the big question is, how do you get the brightest people to want to be here, to come here? See, I think the place where the exciting future is going to be is where people congregate around an intellectual pursuit. Now, that sounds like an elitist kind of stuff, but I think it's true.
Is that how you practice leadership over your career, by trying to facilitate people congregating around an intellectual pursuit?
Well, I had never said it that way until right now, but maybe that is one of the things that I did.
Yeah. You use the word convening a lot today. And
yeah.
Can you think about how you have personally, maybe unintentionally, brought people together when they didn't necessarily, they wouldn't have otherwise gotten together?
Yeah. Well, it's happened over and over again. I can think of some examples, but I remember one of the things we did at PSI when I was there was we were trying to cut costs and become more efficient. And so I put together a group of interdepartmental and interdisciplinary teams to study a specific project, a specific activity. It might be turning on and off electric users. I mean, that's a sample. And I got a former school teacher who was a woman who was the convener of these things. Now, I was actually the convener, but she was in charge of the details and setting the agenda and all that stuff. And you know, this is not a new idea. It's the same thing you find in these other leadership techniques that are espoused by leadership and business experts. But the thing is, it has real energy when you get that group together. These people say, well, I'm doing something that's important. This can change the way we do business here. We can shorten the cycle time and all that kind of stuff. Well, I got a lot of benefits out of that were not originally my intention. All I really wanted was the policy question. How do we do this better? But I got a bunch of other benefits in addition to that.
Yeah, there's something else you've mentioned before is Genesis and how something can turn into something else.
Yeah.
At a meeting, and do you find that you've incorporated that into your personal style of leadership?
I hope so. I told you about the devil's advocate in meetings, and I mentioned today the question of, here we were talking about a four-year degree-granting institution for Indianapolis Public University, and out of the conversation came UNIGOV. So that's pretty fertile territory, right? That kind of a meeting.
I'm going to shift back to some of our standard questions. I'm going to ask you a few more of our standard questions, and then we want to talk to you in the remaining time about Public Service Indiana and Lumina. Do you see a distinction between leadership and management?
Absolutely.
Can you explain a little what those distinctions are?
Well, there's a lot of authors who've done a better job of articulating than I can, but leadership has to do, in my mind, mainly with the motivation of people and the ability to bring the creative instincts and creative ideas out into the open and get them on the table. Management, on the other hand, is taking the visions of leadership and making them work, implementing them, in essence. So they're both important, but I think the roles are different.
Do you think it's possible to be a good leader and a bad manager?
Yes. Yes, we got all kinds of examples in the business world of people who were visionaries, but when their business got to be more mature, they were not the right person to run it at that point.
We have spent quite a bit of time talking about, or getting you to talk about, your style of leadership and to characterize and describe yourself as a leader. And I'm wondering if you can think of one event or incident that best demonstrates your style of leadership? You said, could you pick one thing and as an illustration?
I really can't, because each of these events kind of alters your approach and molds how you do it. But I do think the challenge of a very depressed Indiana workforce when I first became lieutenant governor is the best example I think of, in which we talked about a vision for the future. We talked about a specific group of programs to implement that vision. And then we talked an awful lot about carrying the message, communicating the message. And as I've mentioned to you earlier in my leadership discussion, one of the aspects of leadership is communication. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to be a great public speaker, but you have to find ways to communicate with people on levels other than just the rational. You know, this idea of you can make more money if you do this, that's one motivation, but there's a lot of others.
We have a couple of questions that relate to leadership in terms of impact, influence, perceptions that other people have of leaders. And I've already asked you one of those questions, which is, do you think leaders are born mm-hmm. or made? And we've talked about that. But the other question that I haven't asked you is, do you think it's important or necessary for a leader to have a positive, reasonably well-supported set of goals and projected outcomes?
I think a leader needs to have a vision for where he wants to go, or she wants to go. But sometimes the outcomes are not readily apparent. You know, the Collins, Don Collins, in his book Good to Great and all that sort of thing, one of his things says, first the right people, then the ideas.
So maybe there's a difference sometimes between projected outcomes and actual outcomes?
Yeah. That's right, because I think what you do is, once you get all these people assembled who you hope will be your creative engine and your leadership to implement, you better listen to them. What you think the organization ought to be or do isn't necessarily the right thing. Now, there are certainly other examples of leadership style that are far different than that. If you were to interview Bill Cook, for example, from Cook in Bloomington, Indiana.
I met Mr. Cook.
Yeah. His leadership style is much different in this situation. But you know, it starts with listening. People think Bill just suddenly had all these great ideas and so forth. He is the world's best listener when it comes to talking to medical practitioners. He can sit down with an MD. He's not a doctor. Biology major, maybe, but not a doctor. But when he listens to a physician talk about what it is he needs to get something done to cure this or to cure that and so forth, Bill is a great listener. And then he figures out, well, how can we produce a product that'll get this done? So even in his case, which where he's a different style than I might suggest here, he is a wonderful listener. He also is a person who realizes that there are a lot of other good ideas out there besides his, and he's willing to at least listen to them. He has one interesting characteristic, and that is that he does not like partners, does not want to give up ownership of his business to anybody else. He owns it all. And that's a very unusual kind of approach, you know. But anyway.
One more, actually our final standard question, and that is, can there be a great leader who pursues goals or outcomes of questionable utility or morality? Was Hitler or Idi Amin, were they leaders?
Well, they certainly were leaders.
I just picked two bad people.
Yeah. Well, they're pretty bad. I mean, I guess I'd have to say that, I mean, clearly there are some leaders whose vision is not necessarily morally appropriate or in the best interest of society. And they've been pretty good at taking an awful lot of people to the brink. Ultimately, though, I think that the morality of your actions does confront you at some point in this process. Now, my wife says I'm a dreamer. That's not true. She says a lot of really bad people succeed, and probably they shouldn't. Maybe that'd be her attitude. But I do believe that ultimately the people that you lead catch on.
But if we're, if one of the goals of this project over the long haul is to attempt to figure out what the essence of leadership is, mm-hmm. Do you think that somebody who is pursuing goals or outcomes that are questionable use or questionable morality, mm-hmm. are they actually exercising leadership?
Well, you're asking me whether or not, because the moral aspect or the legal aspect or the what's best for society aspect doesn't seem to be present in their thinking.
Right.
I think most of those people walk down their path thinking that that is not the case, that what they're doing, the goal is so important. It's got this means and ends argument that we deal with all the time, you know. But so I think they think probably they're right. You can't have the zealous drive, and zealous is a negative word, but the determined drive or the enthusiastic drive to succeed if you think what you're doing is wrong. Now, is Tony Soprano a leader? You know, I mean, he's a fictional character on the television program, but is he a leader? Well, yeah, in his element, he is.
So he a mafia boss could be a leader,
yeah.
In his element.
Ken Lay, right?
Yeah. Ken Lay, good example. I went the other day to see that movie called The Smartest Guys in the Room. It's an interesting take on that.
In 1993, you moved from Lilly Foundation to Public Service Indiana, which we've been calling PSI, which then, I believe, was the largest investor-owned utility in the state of Indiana. You served as president of PSI. And so far as I know, you had no prior experience in the electric utility industry. How did this move from Lilly to PSI come about?
Well, it came about because Jim Rogers, who was the chairman of the board of PSI, was in the process of engineering a merger between PSI and Cincinnati Gas and Electric. And the result of that merger was called Synergy. Synergy was then later, just recently, merged with Duke Power, and it's now everybody's going to be called Duke Power. But anyway, Jim believed very strongly in the importance of a community presence, particularly on the part of a utility that serves so many small communities. It wasn't Indianapolis, it was everything around Indianapolis, 52 counties. And so he needed somebody with a fairly high name recognition and persona or presence in the minds of people. And he thought one of the ways to assure Indiana that he wasn't going to turn his back on these communities that had supported him during the hostile takeover with IPL and all the other things he tried to do. So the idea was to bring somebody in who had some credibility and who could maintain the image of the utility during that transition period. That's why I was hired.
I read some of John's research. I'll give credit where credit is due, but there was an article in the Indianapolis Star about the time that you assumed that position. And I'm just going to quote two lines from the article, and I wonder what your reaction is. And the Rogers refers to James Rogers, who was chairman and CEO. Mm-hmm. He said, Rogers was looking for a second in command who could stick up for PSI's Indiana operations once its parent company merges with Cincinnati Gas and Electric Company to form Synergy Corporation and moves to Ohio. Utility watchers believe that Mutz will give PSI something Rogers couldn't, unquestionable loyalty and commitment to Indiana. Do you think that's an accurate statement?
I think it's an accurate statement. Yeah. That's what Jim wanted, and that's what I did.
Were you taking a leadership risk making that move? I mean, you had no background in the utility industry.
Well, of course I was. A lot of people told me I was nuts. Why would you lead Lilly Endowment where you have all this money and all these things to do and so forth? And I saw it as a new challenge, and then I also saw it as an opportunity to do some things that I had never done before. to run a large corporation with, at that time, 4,000 employees, you know. Find out what the corporate inner structure is really like. I'd worked at Alcoa, which is a big company, but I was just a beginner there. This was a different view of that. It was also an opportunity to work with a guy who had respect for in Jim Rogers. Even though he's 10 years younger than I am, he is one of the most innovative corporate leaders I've ever worked with. And so I thought that would be fun too. Now, the other thing is, I think I told you earlier that my situation at Lilly Endowment, could have stayed there, but I think I'd done the things that I could do most effectively. So it was kind of time to move on. So those are factors. Now, the risk, of course, really isn't as great as maybe you think it is, in the sense that utilities at that time had an awful lot of talent inside on the technical stuff. I mean, I wasn't going to screw up the generation of power at one of the power plants.
We weren't
going to
have blackouts.
No, that's right. I mean, my role was at a different level and in a different arena, mainly the political arena as well as the public arena. So I was in an arena there that I was familiar with, even though I'd never been a utility executive. Now, they sent me to utility school for 8 weeks, and the Edison Institute has a program for what they call emerging utility leaders. Everybody in the group laughed at me because I already had the title. You know, they said, well, you don't need to come here. And I said, but you don't understand how little I know about this. But anyway, that's the story.
What were the key issues that you faced as president of PSI?
Well, the first one dealt with the purpose that I was there, the reassurance of local communities and leaders that Jim wasn't leaving them out on a limb. Secondly, it was a time of turmoil in the electric business because the national debate was beginning about deregulation of electricity. And Jim is and continues to be an advocate of deregulation. And our policy, and I must admit my own approach, was one that suggested that deregulation, properly implemented, was a good thing for the consumer and good for the utility business. That whole idea was not very popular with the other utilities in Indiana. The other four electric utilities were not.
And they were Indianapolis Power and Light?
Indianapolis Power and Light, NIPSCO in the northern part of the state, SIGECO in the southern part of the state, the REMC movement, and then AEP, which was an Ohio utility that had the northeast part of Indiana. So I was one among five who was an advocate for competition, and the others didn't like it. That's the second issue. The third issue was related to this business of how do we reduce costs in an industry that traditionally never had to be too concerned about costs. I mean, I know that sounds funny, but in the utility business, you make a new investment, you put it in the rate base, get the IURC, the utility regulators, to approve it and raise rates. And of course, that's one of the reasons, for example, right now that the automobile industry in the United States is in trouble, because they had that kind of monopoly in the automobile business. Suddenly, foreign competition came in and they were not able to compete very well, and they're still struggling with it. Well, we had decided at PSI that we needed to find ways to cut costs and to do it effectively. And so that's the third big challenge. I think those are the ones I'd list as most important.
What do you think you learned about leadership as president of PSI?
Well, I learned, the biggest thing I learned there was the difficulty in moving people to change who didn't want to change.
And that would be on utility deregulation and cost cutting and...
Well, those things, but mainly our own employees. I mean, see, our average employee had been there 24 years. I mean, this was an unusually old workforce. And most of them had in mind the old cycle. Work your career all at one place, get to age 62 or whatever the retirement age would be, retire and go on with a happy life. There was no sense of urgency in this workforce. That was one of the things we were trying to build.
So was workforce motivation and workforce development one of your tasks?
Yeah. But you see, we weren't going to hire a lot of people because they were already there. And so the question is, how do you motivate these people? And I had a number of people who said, John, I really don't care about doing this. I only got 3 more years and then I'm out of here. And some of these people were some of the bright people in the workforce, but they had lost any desire to do that.
If I read my notes correctly, in 1999, you stepped down as president of PSI and became vice chairman?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What did that entail?
Well, what had happened was, actually, I had only signed on for 5 years when I first took the job, but it already had been 7 years, and I wanted to move on to some other things. And I also wanted to teach at Northwestern University, where the Medill School of Journalism had offered me an adjunct professorship for 1 quarter so I could live on campus and teach.
And did you do that?
I did it, yes, that fall. Mm-hmm. That's also the fall I wrote the book called Fundraising for Dummies. And it was a great time. I enjoyed it. My wife and I lived on campus, and I kept office hours, and saw students, and graded papers, and all that sort of thing.
Did anybody ever tell you that the dog ate their homework?
I never had that one, but I had some other excuses, yeah. These were graduate students. Good. They were candidates for master's degrees, and they were pretty serious right. people, and surprisingly pretty old.
Yeah.
My oldest student was 38 years old, so this was not a bunch of kids. They were seasoned people, and many of them had already been out in the work world, you know, so that it was a good experience. So, yes, I did those things.
So vice chairman was
well,
what kind of a position?
Well, it was a position in which I still maintained an office here in Indianapolis. I was responsible for discussions with the other utilities about policy, and I worked directly with our legislative team, the lobbyists who worked for us, because that was something that I also used to supervise. Now, see, when I was actually a utility officer, I also was in charge of foreign investments that we had. So we had investments in the United Kingdom and in South America, rather large ones, and I traveled to those parts of the world on a regular basis to participate in the board meetings and so forth. So it was I'd call it a transition from active involvement to...
So really in 1999 you were transitioning out of PSI.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you ever consider running for mayor of Indianapolis?
I did for a very short period of time. It probably got in the press at one time or another.
I admit it did, yes.
Yeah, I talked about it, yeah. And the party hierarchy at that time thought that Sue Ann Gilroy was the better candidate. And for one reason, I had a lot of arguments politically with the hierarchy at that time. I'm thinking primarily of the sheriff at that time. Jack Cotty was his name, and he was a power in Marion County politics. Jack and I just don't agree on lots of things.
These were political arguments?
Yeah.
What were the nature of those? What did you disagree about?
Well, I think largely I would, well, for example, I was in favor of the consolidation of the police and the fire districts in Marion County. He being sheriff was opposed to it unless he ran it all. We had disagreements about the quality of candidates for office. I hate to get into personal stuff here, but yeah, we disagreed about his approach and techniques and so forth.
So you elected not to run.
Right. Mm-hmm.
In 2002, you became chairman of the City of Indianapolis Department of Water Works.
Mm-hmm.
That was a short-term position?
Well, I could still be there if I wanted to be. I think I was an appointee of the president of the county council, who was Bert Servais.
Right.
Now, I was philosophically opposed to the city buying the water works in the first place. But once it was decided, Bert asked me if I would be his one of the two candidates to be a nominee. And of course, this was a deal which was worked out jointly by Bert Servais and Mayor Bart Peterson.
Right.
And Bart was delighted to have me there because it was a political buffer for him. Here's a high-profile Republican supervising the acquisition and the kinds of difficult employee issues that had to be.
So that was the task, was to supervise the acquisition by the city.
That's right.
Okay. So.
And I stayed on there for I think a year and a half or so, and then some other opportunities came along, and I thought it would be best if I resigned from that.
What were some of the challenges that you faced as you supervised that acquisition?
Well, I think the biggest challenge was the resolution of employee relationships in this new environment. Like most utilities, the people that worked at Indianapolis Water Company had been there a long time. They were the beneficiaries of a monopolistic environment where they had an unbelievable personal benefits in addition to their salaries, pension programs, etc., health insurance, all the rest of it. And of course, the issue was, like in any merger, you've got a company that's you're gonna go to work for now that has a different benefit package. The question is, how do you resolve? That was our biggest issue. And we had lots of difficulties with it. There were demonstrations by disgruntled employees, and I mean, the hearings that we held at that time were well attended, to say the least.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah.
Why were you opposed to the city acquiring the water utility?
Well, philosophically, I think utilities like this are more efficiently run by for-profit organizations, stated very simply. My experience had been at PSI that we were a lot more efficient in spite of our inefficiencies than were the ones that were the electric utilities that were run by cities and things of that kind. I think the profit motive is a good motivation in a utility set of circumstances. I'll put it that way.
Was the motivation behind the city acquiring that water utility, in your opinion, was it related to quality and efficiency of service, or politics, or something else?
It was xenophobia.
Xenophobia.
Here it comes again. Yeah, there was this fear of having a foreign company owning our utility.
And the foreign company was?
Oh, I can't remember now the name of the foreign company. But the logical acquirers, when NIPSCO put it up for sale, see, NIPSCO bought the water company originally because they thought this is a way for
Northern,
us to...
Northern Indiana Public Service
Company. Yes, that's right.
An electric utility.
That's right. And what they wanted to do was to get at the Indianapolis electric customer. They said, so what we do, we'll buy this utility. Now we'll have a base to go after the electric business in Indianapolis. Well, deregulation didn't come to Indiana, so Apalco still had control of that. Water utilities do not perform well economically compared to other investments. I mean, when I was at PSI, Jim Rogers said, John, check this out. So we did an in-depth look at the water company. We decided that we could deploy our capital more efficiently other places. It just was not an acquisition that earned enough money to make sense. So we took a pass on it. I looked at a lot of acquisitions when I was at PSI. So NIPSCO found out the same thing. This is not going to work for us. So they put it up for sale. The only logical buyers were United Water and this French outfit we're talking about. United Water was also owned by a foreign company, and so that's what happened.
Jim Morris worked for the water company at one point.
Yes, he did indeed, and he was still there when I was involved in this transition.
You have been on numerous boards of directors, including Conseco.
Mm-hmm.
When did you serve on the Conseco board of directors?
Well, I want to say that it was from 98. You better check this out. I can't remember. It's on my resume. Yeah.
Actually, probably rule number two in the oral historian's book is don't ask the narrator a date, and I just did it.
Yeah, so. I can't give you exactly.
It
was during the time that I was at Lilly Endowment and at Synergy.
Right. You were on the Conseco board during a time of turmoil and controversy for the company.
Yeah, I missed all the gravy days. Immediately after I became a board member, we began to fall into some of the difficulties that eventually caused the bankruptcy. And
could you summarize those?
Well, the major problem with the company was twofold. One, Steve Hilbert decided that we would branch out into the financial services industry.
And Steve Hilbert was the CEO.
He was the CEO of Conseco. And he was looking for an acquisition, and the acquisition turned out to be the largest provider of financing called Green Tree for manufactured houses. Manufactured housing is a very tough business to begin with, and financing them is much different than regular houses because they deteriorate in value the minute you buy a new one. They're like automobiles rather than houses. There's not an appreciation, generally speaking. So what we did, we bought what appeared to be a very financially successful financier of manufactured housing all over the United States. Huge operation. Added dramatically to the Conseco customer base and fit into Steve's idea of middle America. He said, we are financiers and insurance people for middle America, not for wealthy Americans, not for poor Americans, but middle Americans. And nobody else is really in that space. And that's true. That most people in those financial services businesses want people to top. And so that was the philosophy. Not an unsound philosophy, but the company turned out to be an unsound purchase. And you could make the argument that if you go back and restate the accounting method, that they never made any money in the history of the whole company, even though it appeared that they did. But at stake were two kinds of accounting. And this is a complicated, I won't get into it now, but the point being that during the turmoil there, we actually voted on the board to go to the normal kind of accounting for Green Tree. But it was too late. And then the second thing that happened was the investment community lost their enthusiasm for Steve. Steve was one of these guys, self-made human being, never finished college, went out and raised the money going door to door to get started in the insurance industry. It's a rags to riches. It's a wonderful story. And Steve had a vision about the consolidation of the insurance industry that was very sound and worked. It was an industry full of a lot of waste. And when you brought together two or three insurance companies and consolidated the back office operations, there were great profits there and possibilities for profit. And so, I mean, as a consolidator, Steve was enormously successful. The consolidation, however, with Green Tree was not a good acquisition. And what happened was his reputation for being the high-flying deal maker was damaged.
Because of Green Tree.
And as a result, the investment community began to clamor for his resignation. And I was on the board of Conseco when we had the meeting in which he resigned. And I was one of those who had to sit with him during this time period. This meeting started at 9 in the morning and ended at 7 that night. And it was a very difficult meeting. Now, little did I dream that I'd still be on this board several years later when Gary Wendt, a nationally known business leader who had been successful at GE, became our CEO. And then I was the one who asked to ask Gary Wendt to leave, which I did. I was chairman of the committee for the reorganization of Conseco and chairman of the bankruptcy committee at Conseco.
Because Conseco went into bankruptcy.
That's right.
Receivership.
That's right. And then, of course, when the bankruptcy ended and they, as we say, came out of bankruptcy, established a new accounting system and so forth, then the new owners, of course, had their own people they wanted on the board at that time, and so I resigned.
Was that a leadership risk for you to be on a board like that?
Absolutely. I didn't think it was when I first got involved, or I probably wouldn't have joined that board. And I did a lot of due diligence to try to figure out if it was a company I should go to because they were operating so differently than other people in the insurance business. And what I did was I hired the insurance expert at Ernst & Young here in town to do a careful look for me, because he didn't audit them, he had no relationship with them. And after learning what he told me, as an insurance consolidator, he said they're good. And he also said Raleigh Dick is a sound financial manager, who was the CFO there. And I went in and spent a lot of time with Raleigh, and it's on the basis of those conversations and that research that I joined the board. Now, again, you know, you take a risk when you're on the board of somebody who has the kind of volatile personality and exuberance that a Steve Hilbert has. But I like Steve. I still like Steve. But it was a situation in which, yes, you take a risk when you're involved in a situation like that. Now, the other risk I took was financial. One of the big things that led to lack of confidence in Steve Hilbert was a program he put in place that allowed officers and directors of the company to buy company stock with loans guaranteed by the company. Now, such a program is designed to align the interests of board members and officers with the interests of common shareholders. That is normally considered to be a desirable kind of alignment. The problem we had here was that Steve put no limits on how much of this that these individuals could do. And so you had some directors and some officers who were buying 20 and 30 and many more millions of dollars of Conseco stock with loans guaranteed by the company. And of course, they wanted me to do this too. This is one of the ways you demonstrate to the financial community that you have confidence in your business. And I said, well, yes, I'll participate, but I'm not going to buy any more stock with a loan of this nature that I cannot afford to pay back from my existing monies and assets if everything were to go badly. So I could remember my wife saying to me on several occasions, John, don't be greedy. You know, this is supposed to be the great answer to additional financial success. And I ended up having to pay off my loan at Conseco of $1.3 million. And that was not something you do on the installment basis. That's cash on the barrelhead. You have to pay. And I was one of three members of the board who paid off their loans. Some of those loans are still not paid off, and some are still pending in terms of litigation. Some are settled.
So when the company went bankrupt, those loans were called in, is what I mean.
Not at that time, no. Gary Wendt concluded that you had a conflict of interest on the board if you had a big loan and still served on the board. And I believe Gary was right, and I supported him in this. The point being that this financial obligation becomes so big and so important to you that your actions on behalf of the company and other shareholders is flavored or altered. So Gary went to the board, and he gradually got individuals like me to say, either you pay off your loan or you resign from the board. And I went individually to the other board members and said, I'm going to pay mine off, and I want you to do the same. And if you don't, then we're going to invoke a section in the Indiana statute that allows the board to relieve those directors of their responsibility. It's a section seldom ever used. So, you know, this was tense kind of situation with men and women who you had previously worked with and so forth. But I did get the resignations of all of them except two, and two of them we had to, as Donald Trump would say, we had to fire them. You know, they were relieved from their board responsibilities. And those were not very enjoyable circumstances when you have to deal with that. So then, of course, along came the bankruptcy, and there's a whole lot of people who got hurt in the bankruptcy.
So this business about the loans and the conflict of interest really predated the bankruptcy.
Oh, yes.
So the company was on a downhill slide when this was happening.
That's right.
Would you consider what you were faced with as a member of the board and repaying your own loan and persuading your colleagues to do the same and resignations and firings? Is, does that have anything to do with leadership or the fact that sometimes maybe a leader has to have the courage to do things that are difficult?
Yes, I think it does. I mean, I do think that is a test of leadership when you're put in those situations and you don't run. Now, I've had some people say to me, John, why don't you resign from the board? Why do you want to put up with all this? And I'd be candid with you to say, first of all, I felt I had a responsibility to follow through, but I also felt that my own personal integrity was at stake. I mean, I thought that, you know, maybe the major thing that recommends John Mutz in the long run is not my money, it's not my intriguing ideas, it's my integrity.
I mean, where do you think that integrity fits in the panoply of leadership qualities?
Well, I think it's extremely important. And those are really difficult kinds of moments when you deal with that kind of stuff. I remember another case, which I'll mention real briefly, and that was one of the members of the board of PSI was confronted with a proposal that PSI put on its board a prominent political personality who likely would be elected to the U.S. Senate for the interim time period between when he left one office and took up another. And another board member on the PSI board said, no, Jim, this is Jim Rogers, I don't think this is in the best interest of this company, and I really don't think it's in the best interest of the individual involved. And this happened to be the chairman of the committee that hired Jim Rogers who said this, and Jim says, well, I've heard enough, we won't do it. So he didn't even press the board to do it. That's leadership. And it is the kind of thing, you know, that often makes you unpopular temporarily. And that's happened to me on occasion. But I think of that example. And I have to say that example is one of the things that kind of led me to where I was when I got to the Conseco situation, because it happened before that. And I really did suffer with a lot of these people. I think we did the best we could for Conseco at that point. In fact, the company still exists here in Indianapolis and still employs people is maybe a legacy from that.
You think it's on the rebound?
Yes.
financially, I mean.
Yeah, financially, yes, I think it is. And the trick here, which has nothing to do with leadership particularly, except to say, is they need an A or A-minus rating so that they can sell their insurance products in competition with the other big insurance companies. They're a B-plus something or other right now, and I think they'll get that rating from the insurance rating agencies.
What do you think you learned as a leader from the trials and tribulations of serving on the Conseco board through those difficult times?
Yeah, well,
personal difficult times?
Yeah, I think I learned the importance of even though everybody else seems to be walking to a different drummer, if you really have strong doubts, speak up. And it was not an easy thing to do. Don't get me wrong, I wasn't the only one who felt this way. But I usually was the only one who would articulate it at these meetings.
Do you think there's a difference in when you think about leadership between leadership in a situation like that and leadership in a political arena? I mean, would a politician have been as likely to clearly express strong reservations the way you did in a more private setting?
Often not, but sometimes they do, even though it's an unpopular thing to do. But you know, a lot of the really tough decisions in politics still are not public. There are some moments when you are tested. I don't know where I mentioned or not the time I was offered a bribe or not when I was running for governor.
No, you didn't mention that.
Well, I was raising money and doing all the things you do, and I was down in southern Indiana, and a group of county commissioners in one county asked to have a meeting with me in a conference room of a private airport in Clarksville, Indiana, and which I did. I made a big mistake at that meeting. For some reason or another, I didn't have a staff person with me, a witness. I should have had. And we sat down at the table, and these guys described their economic development project. And it appeared to me being nothing more than a request to give them some money to build a road in their community. And I said, well, there's no jobs at the end of this road right now. Maybe there will be someday, but there aren't now. I said, our program isn't for that and so forth. Well, at that moment, this one guy threw this envelope on the table, and all these checks fell out on the table. They were checks made out in blank, signed with amounts on them, which the recipient could have filled in. And I looked at the checks. I didn't touch them. I didn't pick them up. I just looked. I knew what they were after I could read the front of them. And I said, I'm leaving. I never want to talk to you guys about any of this again. And you see, had I had a witness, I would be in a position to have maybe confronted them in another way. Mm-hmm. I made a big mistake. I should have had somebody with me.
In the last couple of minutes that we have left, I want to do two things. I want to ask you to describe what you do at Lumina Foundation, and then I want to give you a chance to say anything that I wasn't smart enough or clever enough to ask you, or that John didn't beat me with a stick hard enough to help me figure out what to say. So can you are now the president of Lumina Foundation?
No, I'm chairman of the board.
Okay, CEO. You're chairman of the board. What is Lumina Foundation, and what are your leadership responsibilities there?
Well, my leadership responsibilities are to lead the board and be the major consultative individual with the CEO. Martha Lampkin is the president and CEO. I believe this style of leadership is the coming thing, not just in the nonprofit world, but I think eventually we're going to have a division between the executive and the board chairman in more and more corporations. I think it's the right thing to do, but that's another day. At any rate, Lumina Foundation is what's called a conversion foundation. It's a foundation which was formed from the assets that were acquired when USA Group, another nonprofit, sold its assets to Sallie Mae, and we got $400 million in cash and $380 million in Sallie Mae stock, New York Stock Exchange company. And then when you get all that money, it's not yours. It's in the public's purview. So we formed the new foundation, and that's what Lumina is. And it is committed to access and success in post-high school education and training of all kinds. Our major emphasis currently is on community colleges nationally, and secondly, on how to solve the community cost problem of getting a college education.
So you make grants to community colleges?
Well, we do, but we're interested in policy changes. We don't do scholarships or anything like that. And we're interested in how you change the system so it's more effective. And so our national program of community colleges right now is operative in 7 states, and it'll gradually expand. And our program on college costs is aimed at 2 aspects of college costs. One is the sticker price that the family or the individual pays, and the second one is the actual cost of education within the institution. They are 2 entirely different things, and they're related, but they're entirely different things. So that's the work we're doing there. But my major responsibility there has been to put a brand new foundation, get it up and going. And not many people get a chance to do that. You know, it's kind of like the economist who gets to build his own country. You know, that's what happened in Latvia and Lithuania. They suddenly had a chance to redo the system. But at any rate, that was the difficulty. And of course, I inherited a board which came from the two organizations that spawned this thing.
So USA and Sally Mae.
Yeah. So I had four Sally Mae directors and seven, I guess that's right, directors from USA Group. And it was a challenge. Now, I was not board chairman to start with. Another gentleman from Washington, D.C., Ed McCabe, was the board chairman. They made me the vice chairman with the assumption that they'd move me up to chairman when he retired as board chairman. Now, he was in his 89 and it would be 90 some odd years when he retired. And so they, because of my foundation experience at Lilly and
Mallon. How did you get hooked up with Lumina Foundation?
Well, I got hooked up with Lumina because I was a director of USA Group beforehand. Okay. I was one of the ones that moved over.
Okay.
And I got to be a director of USA Group primarily, I suppose, because of my experience as lieutenant governor and as PSI and all the other stuff. I mean, your exposure in some of these other situations makes you a candidate for some of the other alternatives. That's what happened.
How do you exercise leadership as chairman of the board?
Well,
and I misspoke earlier. I said CEO, and I know better, so we'll correct that for the record.
All right. Well, you exercise leadership, I think, through two ways. One is your direct influence on the CEO. And my relationship with the CEO is a very strong one. It's a consultative relationship.
Who is the CEO?
Martha Lampkin.
Okay.
Right. And she talks to me privately and casually about all kinds of things that are on her mind. See, CEOs, that's a lonely position. And they don't have a whole lot of people they can talk to, maybe a spouse, but not a whole lot of people you want to share some of these difficult questions, particularly personnel questions and so forth. So as board chairman, that's one role I play. And I do have quite a bit of influence on what happens through Martha. The second is that the board is responsible for developing the overall work plan for the foundation and for the management of the assets of the foundation. See, we have now almost $300 billion. The reason we got so much money is that Sally Mae's stock was an anti-recessionary stock, and it doubled in value in 6 months. So that's why we're as big as we are. We're next to Lilly Endowment, we're the largest foundation in Indiana. So in developing the policy for the work of the foundation and the policy for the investment, and we do that at the board level. Now see, I've set up a much different kind of philosophy about this board than Tom Lake did at Lilly. We have a committee system, and most of the power is vested in the committees. Our investment committee has a very big agenda and a lot of authority to control the policy and what we do. Our program policy committee has a lot of authority in terms of the program. Our compensation committee has a lot to do with how we compensate our employees and benefits and all that sort of thing. So I've vested the power in the committees, and I've given the committee chairman lots of authority. But in every case, they consult with me on most of the issues before they do them. So that's a different technique.
Is there anything that you'd like to say about your leadership experience or your leadership style or what you've learned as a leader that I just haven't had the insight to ask you?
Gosh, you gentlemen have been very thorough in your research and in your questioning. And there isn't anything I can add except to say that people who think of themselves as leaders or who seek to be leaders need to do what we've done here. This business of being asked to think in depth about the questions you've raised, and then the second thing of just laying out the history of what's happened to you over your life, it is a very valuable experience.
So you think embedding those questions in some modified life history worked?
Yeah, but not just that. I think they've also, this exercise probably makes me better equipped to lead in whatever ways I may have an opportunity to do so in the future. It's a, well, one of the things we used to say about organizational leadership is that there's power in history. And one of the things that we did in every group I've been involved in, almost, we did a timeline, and we actually put a big piece of paper up on the wall, and the first date is the founding or whatever the beginning of the organization is, and you bring it up to the present. Now, on the lowest level, you put world events on there, you know, Second World War, Beatles come to America, stuff that's both cultural and historic. Then you have a next line, which is history at the local level, wherever you operate. And then the top line is the history of the organization. And in that, at Lillian Davitt, we even had the names of the officers of the foundation back from the beginning, and when they came and when they left and when certain programs were started and stuff like that. You know, there is amazing power in the study of your history. It gives you an insight that you would never guess. I mean, I must admit, I was one of those skeptics about this, you know. What good does it do to go back and look at history?
Well, that's one of the agendas that's folded into this project, is to try to see if an understanding of the history of leadership is of use to people who are leaders in the present.
Well, organizationally, I can say without doubt it is very helpful. And I think now, having experienced this set of interviews, I can think it would be valuable to the leaders individually. Now, whether an espouse, a leader, a young person moving up the ladder and all that sort of thing, how they would feel about this, I don't know for sure. But I told you earlier that I did a lot of reading in this field, and I think it did assist me in that time period. So, you know, I think it's both good for individuals and organizations.
Well, Mr. Mutz, thank you very much for taking the time to sit with us through four interviews and to share your insights with us. And I learned much more from this than I contributed. I'll tell you that. It's a very interesting and illuminating experience for me. So thank you very much. And thanks to John for
the
background research.
Yeah. Well, I learned more from it than I gave to it, no question.